4 seconds. So, just to finish that last point, the rich man wakes up in torment and he sees Lazarus afar off in Abraham's bosom, and they have that conversation. And it reminds me of so many people today who say, well, if I could just see a miracle, I would believe. But Abraham said that was not true. If they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither would they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead. We can assuredly say the same thing today. Here's a book full of miracles, written especially to make us believe, and if we hear not Christ and the apostles, neither would we be persuaded if we saw a ton of miracles in our time. What is a miracle? A miracle is an interference with nature by supernatural power. And a miracle, by definition, is an exception. A lot of people think that it's harder for people in our time to accept the idea of miracles than it was for ancient people. But I'm not convinced that that's true. When Joseph, the New Testament Joseph, discovered that his fiancée was going to have a baby, he not unnaturally decided to repudiate her. Why? Because he knew just as well as any modern gynecologist knows that in the ordinary course of nature, women don't have babies unless they have had sex with men. If miracles were not known to be contrary to the laws of nature, how could they suggest the presence of the supernatural? How could they be surprising unless they were seen to be exceptions to the rules? And how can anything be seen as an exception until the rules are known? Have you ever watched a baby watch magic tricks? They're no more amazed by magic tricks than they are by anything else that happens around them. Why? Because they're still learning the rules. When Amber was a baby, we were driving through some amazing scenery out in the western part of our country, so we put her up to the window so she could see it, but all she wanted to look at was the locking mechanism on the door. That was just as interesting to her as the beautiful scenery, because to a baby, one thing is as meaningful as another, as long as it doesn't involve pain or hunger. Nothing can seem extraordinary until you have discovered what is ordinary. And it's the business of science to tell us what normally occurs. A lot of people think that the advancement of science has made it harder to accept miracles, but we always knew that miracles were contrary to the natural course of events. If Joseph, the New Testament Joseph, had lacked faith in God, or if he had lacked trust in the holiness of Mary, he could have disbelieved the miraculous origin of her son just as easily as any modern man. And conversely, any modern man who believes in God can accept the miracle of the virgin birth as easily as Joseph did. We talk about the immensity of the universe and people use it as an argument. The immensity of the universe is not a recent discovery. 1,800 years ago, Ptolemy taught that in relation to the stars, the Earth must be regarded as a point with no magnitude. His astronomical system was accepted all through the years. The insignificance of the Earth in size was accepted way back in the days of King Alfred, way back in the days of Dante, as it is today. The vastness and the emptiness of the universe is used as evidence against God quite often. But here's the thing. If we were to find lots of habitable bodies and lots of civilizations on them, that also would be used as evidence against the existence of God, because we're very hard to please. Fact is that whatever God does will be used as evidence against him. We just need to remember that if we are a small thing to space and time are a much smaller thing to God. One of our problems here is that we have imagination. So when a quantity of something becomes very great, we cease to regard it as a mere quantity because our imaginations awaken. And instead of mere quantity, we now have a sublime quality attached to it in our minds. This is why we look out at the ocean with such amazement, and it's just never enough. We look at the night sky with awe. The silence of the incalculable spaces fills us with a sense of mystery, a sense of the numinous. Ancient poetry in the Bible and out, shows us that humans have always felt this way. With God, all things are possible, but not even omnipotence can do what is self-contradictory. God, even God, cannot do that which is intrinsically impossible. Could God create a square circle? No, because if it was square, it wouldn't be a circle. It's impossible by definition. Think of that the next time somebody asks you if God could create a rock so big he couldn't move it. That used to be a popular question when I was in high school. And really, it tends to fall into the category of foolish questions that Paul told Timothy to avoid, but I think if somebody asks it in sincerity, honestly wanting to know, then we should discuss it. Even God cannot do that which is definitionally impossible, and God cannot violate his own nature. If you tell yourself that God can do just absolutely anything, ask yourself if God can lie. The Bible says in a couple of places that it's impossible for God to lie. That's something you can do that God can't do. God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. It's impossible for God to commit any sin. So a miracle within all that context is like a doctoring. A miracle is like a tampering. It's almost like cheating in a way. It introduces a new factor into the situation, and that factor is supernatural force. It's not that a miracle breaks the laws of nature. If God annihilates or creates or deflects a unit of matter, he has just created a new situation, and nature just naturally assimilates that new situation and then adapts all other events to it. Miraculous wine has all the properties of natural wine. A miraculous conception is a real pregnancy. Inspired books suffer all the ordinary processes of textual corruption. Miraculous bread will be digested in the natural way. Miracles do not suspend the pattern to which events conform. They just feed new events into that pattern, and then nature naturalizes the result. Nature is an accomplished hostess. She handles this with no problem. So the cause of a miracle is God, but the results of a miracle follow according to natural law. A miracle in the time following its occurrence is interlocked with all of nature just like any other event. Its peculiarity is that it's not in that way interlocked backward with all of previous history of nature. People who take nature as the whole entire of reality have a problem with miracles, obviously, because they have mistaken a partial system within reality, that is nature, as the whole of everything. In calling supernatural events miracles, we don't mean that they're contradictions. We mean that left to her own resources, nature could never produce them. If water sticks in your throat, what are you going to use to wash it down with? The problem for the naturalist is that nature, to them, is just a word for everything. But nature, biblically, is just a creature. It's only us supernaturalists who see nature as it really is. The Christian faith itself is the story of a great miracle. When we're talking about something which is not perceptible by the five senses, we use words that refer to words, to things or actions that are perceptible by the senses. For instance, we say we grasp an argument. We're using the verb grasp, which literally means to take something in your hands, but we're not thinking that our mind has hands, literally, or that an argument can be seized like a gun. No, but in order to avoid the word grasp, we might say, I see your point, but we don't mean that a pointed object has suddenly appeared in our visual field. We might say, I follow you, but that doesn't mean that I'm walking behind you. We're all familiar with metaphors of this nature, and if we're going to talk about things that are not perceived by the senses, we're forced to use language metaphorically. Some things can't be discussed without metaphor. But Jesus turning water into wine is meant perfectly literally. It's well within the reach of human senses and human language. Jesus turned water into wine. So we're not involving metaphor in this at all. If I say my heart is broken, you know I don't mean it literally. And you know that a broken heart cannot be verified at a postmortem. But if I say my shoestring is broken, and you look down and see that it's not, then you know I'm either lying or mistaken. We're on a literal level there. The accounts of the miracles in first century Israel are either lies, legends, or history. If they're lies or legends, then Christianity is false. But it was always impossible for God not to exist. God is so brimful of existence that he can give existence away. There never was a time when nothing existed, otherwise nothing would exist now. We learned yesterday that Ted doesn't like messes, and I don't think many of us do, especially other people's messes. Our repugnance to disorder is derived from God. He is the author of order, and He put within us the expectation of systematic order, which made possible the creation of modern science. We became scientific because we expected law in nature. We expected law in nature because we believed in a creator and we saw order in His creation. What explanation can you give for the life, sayings, and influence of Jesus that's not harder to believe than the Bible's explanation? The non-Christian hypotheses, the theories that are used to explain Jesus in a natural way have succeeded each other in a bewildering fertility of confusion. They remind me of the conspiracy theories about the JFK assassination. They never get any traction because there's nothing there. When we're asked to view all the theological elements of the Jesus narrative as later accretions to the story of a so-called historical and merely human Jesus, upon examination, it just doesn't ring true. Prior to that, we were told that the whole Jesus story began with the vegetation myths and the mystery religions. It just doesn't make sense. Now, that's getting outside the scope of this class. But the Jesus of the Bible is the one who integrates and who illuminates everything else we know. Some of the elements of the Bible's explanation of Jesus may not be fully comprehensible to us at any given time. It's kind of like as we sit here today, we believe that the sun is in the sky, not because we can clearly see the sun. In fact, we can't, so please don't try. We believe the sun is in the sky, not because we can see the sun, but because we can see everything else. What can be meant by God becoming man? I don't think anything we can do will allow us to imagine the consciousness of the incarnate God. But our own composition, our existence as body, soul, and spirit, is just a faint image of the divine incarnation. How well can you really understand how your spirit, your human spirit, dwells in the midst of your body, as Daniel in the Old Testament said that his did? This is the same theme as the incarnation, but in a very minor key. Death and rebirth. To go down is to go up. This is a key principle since the fall of man. Ask yourself this question. Why should the only religion of a dying God, which has actually survived and has any possibility of being true, why should that occur precisely among those people to whom the whole circle of ideas that belonged to that dying God was foreign? The only dying God who might possibly have been historical holds bread and says, "This is my body." The very thing which the nature religions are all about seems to have really happened once, but it happened in a circle of people where no trace of nature religion was present or allowed. It's like you suddenly met the Loch Ness Monster and found that the Loch Ness Monster doesn't believe in the Loch Ness Monster. Isis and Osiris were derived from the facts of nature, and the facts of nature were derived from the Creator. Birth and rebirth as a pattern in nature was there because it first came from God. But nature religion is so strikingly absent from the teaching of Jesus and from the Judaic preparation that led up to Jesus, because in them, nature's original was manifesting itself. In them, we've gotten behind the nature religion and behind nature itself, where the real God is present. And where the real God is present, the shadows of God don't need to appear. That which the shadows resembled does. The Hebrews, of course, throughout their whole history, were constantly headed off from the worship of the nature gods. Not because the nature gods were in all respects unlike the one true and living God of nature, but because they were just pale imitations of the one true and living God. It's as just as the shadows in Judaism prefigured reality, so the shadows in paganism to some extent prefigured reality too. Myth prefiguring the eventual fact. The one nation that turned away from the likenesses of paganism to the Creator Himself was Israel. And those chosen were chosen not only for their own sake, but these chosen were chosen for the sake of the unchosen. In thy seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed. On that finely selected woman, Mary, fell the utmost depth of maternal anguish. Her son, the incarnate God, is a man of sorrows, the one man into whom deity descended, the one man who can lawfully be worshipped. In our species, the Lord of nature is now included. There's a union between God and nature in the person of Jesus Christ, and it will never be reversed. 30 years after he had left us here, he was called the man Christ Jesus. He's called the man Christ Jesus decades after he left. Just as when spring comes, it leaves no corner of the land untouched. Just as a pebble dropped into a pond sends circles clear to the edge. Death is the thing that Christ came to conquer, and death is the means by which he conquered it. So that our last enemy, death, becomes our servant, it becomes the means by which we eventually get out of here. Jesus was a man who did not need to have been a man at all. He served in our regiment as a volunteer. This one, who was perfectly a man, performed the perfect dying for us. So the miracles in the New Testament are different from the mythological miracles that we read about in fairy tales or in pagan religions. The Christian miracles are exactly what would be expected to happen if nature was invaded by the God of nature, a power which is outside the jurisdiction of nature, not as a foreigner, but as a sovereign. The miracles proclaim that he who has come is not merely a king, but he is the king. He is nature's king and our king. The incarnate God suddenly and locally does something that God has done or will do in general. Jesus is the center of God's entire spiritual universe. Just as the Son is giving us the energy that we need on earth, so Jesus, the Son of Righteousness, is risen with healing in his wings. He's the center and the circumference of everything. Anything that doesn't come from Jesus has no authority. Anything that doesn't lead to Jesus has no validity. We can categorize the miracles of Jesus in an interesting way, I think. Jesus performed miracles of fertility. Jesus is the reality, for example, behind the false god Bacchus, who was so worshipped by the people who believed the myths. Every year, as a part of the natural order, God makes wine, because God created a vegetable organism that can turn water, soil, and sunlight into a juice that the Bible describes as wine. God is constantly turning water into wine. Wine, like all drinks, is just water modified. Some of you have drinks where you're sitting right now, and those drinks, no matter what they are almost entirely water. The miracle consists in the shortcut. The event to which it leads is the usual one, water to wine. That's the usual event, but Jesus just short-circuited the usual way of bringing it about. We have two instances of miraculous feeding, the feeding of the 5,000, the feeding of the 4,000. One time in the wilderness, Satan tempted Jesus to change stone into bread. There are probably several reasons why he didn't do that, but maybe it appeared to him that that was not quite in the Father's style. After all, the Son does nothing except what he sees the Father do. But a little bread into much bread is a different matter. Every year, God makes a little corn into a lot of corn. Seed is sown, and there is an increase. People say, well, it's the laws of nature, or they used to say it is Ceres, or it's Adonis, or it's the Corn King. But the laws of nature are just a pattern. As for Adonis, he was supposed to die and rise again, but nobody can give us any clue about when Adonis died or when he rose again. At the feeding of the 5,000, on the other hand, we find him in whom we had ignorantly worshipped as the real Corn King, who is going to go on to die once and to rise once at Jerusalem during the term of Pontius Pilate. He's right there in history. The clocks would have been ticking if they had been there. On that same day, he multiplied fish. Look at any fish hatchery in our time. The swarming, undulating fecundity shows God still at work, thronging the seas with innumerable spawn. God at the beginning set all kinds of life to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Jesus shortcut that, and locally, under his human workman hands, he did what he's always been doing in the seas, lakes, and rivers. The genius of the virgin birth, the embodiment of the one who would not simply be man, but the man, God in the flesh, is that God, for a moment, removed the great glove of nature from his hand and touched Mary with a direct and uncontaminated injection of essential life. Jesus performed miracles of healing. Doctors don't really heal, and they themselves are the first to say that. There is a recuperative, there is a self-corrective energy built into your human body. Treatment can only stimulate the natural functions or remove what is hindering them. God so built your body that a cut heals itself. A cut doesn't heal on a corpse. But this same mysterious force that we call gravitational when it steers the planets and that we call biochemical when it heals your body is the efficient cause of all recoveries. That energy proceeds from God. All who are cured by God, not merely in the sense that His providence provides them with medical assistance and wholesome environments, but also in the sense that your very tissues are repaired by that far-reaching energy which, flowing from Him, energizes the whole system of nature. Jesus came and He did it visibly to the sick in Israel, the man meeting with men. The thing people call the laws of nature, they used to call the power of Asclepius. Asclepius was worshipped under the form of a snake in places like Pergamum. There was quite an elaborate temple to Asclepius in the city of Pergamum. And they had a snake tunnel there at Pergamum with thousands of snakes on the inside. You could not only feed your sacrifice to the big snake in the temple, but then if you wanted to be healed, you weren't feeling well, you go to the snake tunnel, you lay down there all night and try to sleep while these thousands of snakes are crawling, slithering, and creeping over you, so that when you got away from those snakes, that at best next morning you probably did feel a little better, and lo and behold, you're healed. We used to call it Asclepius, but it revealed itself in Jesus, this power that is always behind all healings. It put on a face and hands in Jesus, hence the apparent chanciness or randomness of the miracles of Jesus. I've heard people complain that in the Gospels, Jesus only heals those people whom He happens to meet, and He doesn't heal those that He doesn't meet. But to be a man means to be in one place and not in any other at that given time. How many times have you wanted to be in two or three places at once and felt like you needed to be in two or three places at once? That's the story of my life and maybe yours. Actually, sadly, it accounts for a lot of my speeding tickets. In Jesus, though, the world refused to know God as present everywhere, and so that's why He came. He was saving people by becoming local and just being able to deal with one situation at a time. He was a healer. Number three, we have Jesus recorded as performing one miracle of destruction, the withering of the fig tree. This is often troublesome to people, but the moral significance is plain. It's just a parable acted out. It communicates God's sentence on all unfruitfulness, especially the unfruitfulness of the official Judaism of Jesus' age. As a miracle, it again repeats locally what God does constantly throughout nature since the fall of man, the death of organisms. He is the God of death because death has become part of the very mode by which organic life spreads out and yet remains new, death and rebirth. Tad talked yesterday about the trees on his land. A forest of 1,000 trees is still collectively alive because some trees are dying and others are growing up. Jesus' human face turned with negation in its eyes on that one fig tree to make a point. One time, what His omnipotent action eventually does to all trees, He did to one specific tree. You know, I was sitting over here a few years ago, and there was a tree that came out and shaded us better than it does now because a part of it has died off. This is the natural process of events. That tree is not what it used to be. I still sit there for the same reason that I still carry a comb. My hair looks the same whether I comb it or not, but habits just die hard. The point is, the year that Jesus killed that tree in Israel, no tree died a natural death in Israel that year or any other year anywhere, died except because God did that or ceased to do something to it and for it. God is in control of this. He's handling it. It's energy. Also, there are miracles, number four, of dominion over inorganic nature. When Jesus stills the storm, He does what God has so often done before. Nature is built such that there are storms and there are calms. In that way, all storms, except those that are still going on at the moment somewhere, have been stilled by God. In a minor way, you can still a storm in your room by closing the window or shutting the door. Most storms don't get to you in your room after you do that. The system of nature was not in in the least thrown out of gear by Jesus stilling a storm, because nature is such an accomplished hostess. Nature just simply digested that new situation immediately, as easily as an elephant digests a drop of water. When Jesus walks on water and allows Peter to do so, we have possibly a foretaste of the kinds of things that our new bodies will do in the future. For just a moment, those two men were living in that new world. Then Peter's faith failed him and he slipped back, but that momentary glimpse is like a snowflake of a miracle that quickly melted away and shows us, perhaps, what is coming for us. Number five, miracles of reversal occurred when the dead were raised. Nature, of course, knows nothing of this process. But Jesus raised at least three people from the dead besides himself. There was a little girl who had died, and Jesus raised her. Some would say that she was just suffering from the suspension of the vital processes, and in that day of ignorance, she wasn't really dead. And when Jesus resuscitated her, he just fooled people. But he raised then a young man who was on his way out to be buried. Jesus touched the casket, the young man sat up, and was restored to the arms of his widowed mother. But people still say the same thing. Maybe he wasn't really dead. But you can't say that about Lazarus. His sister said he's been dead so long, but this time he stinks. When you open that tomb, you're going to smell him. But they opened the tomb. Jesus said, "Lazarus, come forth," and Lazarus came out. These cases are like early spring flowers, blooming while it's still really winter, prefiguring what will happen to the sleeping dead when the Lord returns. Jesus' own transfiguration and resurrection and ascension are even more emphatic, showing the true spring that is to come. Well, you and I are still back here among the frost. The captain and pioneer of our salvation is showing us the month of May that is to come. In the New Testament, to preach the Christian faith meant primarily to preach the resurrection. People who heard what Paul said at Mars Hill got the impression that he was talking about two new gods. Since Jesus was, Iesus was a male expression and Anastasis was a female expression, many languages have those, Ted talked about that yesterday, they thought he was talking about Iesus and Anastasis, Jesus and the resurrection. The resurrection was the central theme in every Christian sermon reported in Acts. The first fact in the history of the Christian faith is the number of people who say they have seen the resurrected Jesus. Christ's achievement in rising from the dead was the first event of its kind in the whole history of the universe. He is the first fruits of them that slept, the pioneer of life. Jesus kicked open a door that had been locked since the death of Abel. He met, fought, and beat the king of death. And everything is different now because he did that. This is the beginning of the new creation. It's a new chapter in cosmic history that has opened. Because the resurrection of Jesus was not just an instance of survival or revival. We even had those in the Old Testament, people being raised from the dead. But those raised like Lazarus had to die again. In fact, there was soon a plot to kill him to get rid of the evidence. The restoration of Lazarus was as inferior in splendor to the glorious resurrection of Jesus as those five little barley loaves were to the amber waves of grain ready for harvest as far as the eye can see. The restoration of Lazarus, as amazing as it was simply a reversal, a series of changes working in the opposite direction to what we have always experienced. At death, of course, matter which is organic immediately begins to ebb away into that which is inorganic, flesh and blood breaking down, with the possibility of being used by other organisms. That's how the death and rebirth factor works. We're just living now in these secondhand suits of skin. There may be atoms in my lips, even as I'm saying this, that have served other men in the past, or maybe a dog, or maybe an eel, or maybe a dinosaur. What's in my lips now maybe was used by them one time. Even your own body, as you're sitting here this morning, is not composed of the same particles that it was even a few years ago. Your form remains one, though the matter in it continually changes out. You got a lot of dust in your house? A lot of that is just pieces of you. The miracle of Lazarus was a reversal because we live in a universe where organisms are always getting more disorganized. Irreversible death and irreversible entropy cover most of what Paul was talking about in the 8th chapter of the Roman letter when he refers to the vanity and futility to which nature has been subjected since sin entered the world. "Dying thou shalt die," Adam was told, and it changed everything. everything. And the film is never reversed, and it doesn't run backward. The movement from more order to less order seems to show the direction in which time is flowing. Time doesn't run backward. In this world, we could actually define the future as the period in which what is now living will be dead, as the period in which what order remains will be diminished from the order that now is. But Humpty Dumpty is not the whole story. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. But entropy, a nature that is running down, is not the whole story. Humpty Dumpty is going to be up on the wall again, in the sense that what has died is going to recover life in a reordering, a regeneration. The transformation or metamorphosis of Jesus, thank you, Brett, is an anticipatory glimpse of something to come. He is seen conversing with two of the ancient dead. The change in his human form to luminosity or shining whiteness is similar to his appearance at the beginning of the book of Revelation. This shining or whiteness even affected his clothes as much as his body. Part of my amazement at Superman when I was a boy was that Superman's clothes didn't get damaged no matter what he did. Because I, as a boy, was always getting holes in the knees of my pants, and my mom didn't like that. Made her want to slap me in the next Tuesday. But Superman could walk through fire, and his clothes were fine. Just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's clothes didn't even smell like smoke when they came out of the furnace. In fact, Mark, talking about the transfiguration, says that no laundry could do anything like the change that occurred to Jesus' clothes at the transfiguration. We have to emphasize that we know very little about the new nature of the next life. Even here in this world, though, and Tad pointed this out yesterday as well, if our senses were differently responsive, we would be admitted here in this world to quite different worlds of experience. If you had the vision of a hawk, for example, Ted very aptly pointed out how you don't need the vision of a hawk, and it might even be distracting if you had it, but you just imagine it for a moment. Being able to see that mouse way down there, it's just stunning to even think about. So maybe time won't always be for us as it is here, linear and irreversible. Nearly all we're told about the next world is metaphorical because we wouldn't be able to understand it anyway. We just know that the new world is going to be interlocked at some point with the old. You will still be you, and you will have memories of your earth life. The fact that your body now may feel irrelevant to the highest reaches of the spiritual life is just a symptom of the fact that flesh and spirit are at war with each other. Our estrangement as spirits from nature and as bodies from spirit explains a lot of the way we feel about these things. When nature and spirit are finally fully harmonized, then there's not going to be room to get even a razor blade between spirit and nature. God made the world, He called it good, and our natural environment cannot be simply irrelevant. Heaven is not merely a state of the spirit, but it's also a state of the body as well. Now, the ancient philosophers regarded the body as merely an encumbrance. They looked forward to getting rid of their body. But we who are in Christ believe in the resurrection of the body. Our Christian faith does not teach us to desire a total release from the body, not to be unclothed, but to be reclothed, as the Apostle Paul puts it. Thinking of heaven as merely a state of mind causes our hope to grow languid and insipid, and that reduces our motivation to live the Christian life. God wants to give us a new world of wealth untold and a new body for spiritual life. But who's going to trust me with the true wealth if I can't even be trusted with the wealth that perishes? Who's going to trust me with a spiritual body if I can't even control my earthly body? So we need to learn to manage. We need to learn to possess our vessel in sanctification and in honor. Jesus is never going to die again, and that's why he's the first fruits. This is a whole new order of creation called the new creation. Maybe should give you quickly a list of miracles, and then I want to get on to something else. But miracles of Jesus during his earthly lifetime, you'll be familiar with most, probably all, of these, but I quickly should do it. They were given for three different reasons. One, to make believers, two, to confirm the words, Hebrews chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, and then also they were used as apostolic credentials, 2 Corinthians 12, verse 12. The signs of an apostle were wrought among you. So, a list of the about 40 miracles of Jesus that we have recorded. Number one was obviously water to wine. Two, nobleman's son, the first recorded healing miracle. Three, healing the impotent man. Four, the first draught of fishes. Master, we have toiled all night and taken nothing, but Jesus was not only the landlord, he was also the sea lord. Five, the demoniac in the synagogue. He was not only the landlord and the sea lord, but the lord of the Sabbath also. Six, healing Peter's mother-in-law. Seven, mass healings. Eight, the cleansing of the leper. Nine, the healing of the paralytic. Ten, the healing of the man with the withered hand. And I have references for all these, but we don't have time for it. The healing of the centurion servant is number 11. 12 is the raising of the widow's son. 13, the stilling of the tempest. 14, the healing of the two blind men. 15, the miracle of the dumb demoniac. I should probably say mute. Number 16, the Gadarene demoniac. 17, raising Jairus' daughter. 18, healing the woman with the issue of blood. 19, feeding the 5,000, which is in all four of the Gospels, remarkably. 20, walking on the water. 21, healing the Syrophoenician's woman's daughter. 22, healing the deaf and dumb man of Decapolis. 23, feeding the 4,000. 24, the healing of the Bethsaida blind man. 25, the transfiguration. 26, the healing of the demonic boy, which unfolds in three stages. The father is sad, the demon is mad, and the crowd then is glad. 27, the coin in the fish's mouth. 28, the miracle of the man born blind in John 9. 29, the healing of the woman infirm for 18 years. 30, the healing of a man with dropsy. 31, raising Lazarus. 32, the healing of the 10 lepers. 33, the healing of blind Bartimaeus on the Jericho road. 34, the withered fig tree. 35, healing Malchus' ear. 36, the Lord's resurrection. He was definitely involved in that. Yes, Paul said on Mars Hill that God raised him from the dead, but Jesus had predicted, destroy this temple, speaking of the temple of his body, and I will raise it again in 3 days. So he was definitely involved in his own resurrection somehow. 37, the second miraculous catch of fish. 38, the post-resurrection appearances. 39, the ascension into heaven. And 40, just a lot of extra miracles in mass. I've got three columns of scriptures about those, and you could count each one of those if we knew about them as an individual miracle. But the Lord wants us to know that a lot more was done. There was never anything niggardly about the dispensation of his blessings. Whenever he went someplace, wherever he saw need, he exercised his divine vocation as healer and helper. Interestingly, there's a subset of seven healings on the Sabbath day. The impotent man, the man born blind, the demoniac in Capernaum, Peter's mother-in-law being healed, the man with the withered hand, which includes an explicit statement of the anger of Jesus, the woman who was bowed together, the man with dropsy. Seven miracles that were healings, seven healings done by Jesus on the Sabbath day. Obviously, seven is not a random Bible number. The Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. And he gave us seven miracles that Jesus performed, seven healings that were done on the Sabbath day. I think the recording of seven of them done on the Sabbath day surely was intentional. Seven of those is enough, and about 40 miracles is enough. Just for a moment, though, think of the miracles that Jesus did not perform, because this makes an important point as well. There were miracles suggested to Jesus that he could have done, but did not do. If thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. That would have abused his power, so he refused. In Samaria, it was suggested that they call down fire from heaven and consume people. But you know not what manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. When the mob came to Gethsemane, Jesus said to Peter, don't you realize that I could pray to my Father and he'd give me more than 12 legions of angels to fight these people? This is another miracle that Jesus did not perform. At his trial, his enemies tried to get him to perform miracles, but he wouldn't, because his power was not intended to satisfy their wicked curiosity. On the cross, his enemies taunted him, if you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. But he chose to die so we could live. The miracles that he did not do make a statement all their own. And in addition to the about 40 writers of the Bible and the about 40 miracles of the Bible reports about 40 parables of Jesus. The miracles speak of his works, and the parables speak of his words. And his words and his work go hand in hand, as he himself pointed out in the book of John. Both his words and his works are important. The parables, interestingly, comprise more than a third of the recorded teachings of Jesus. He put us to thinking by using word pictures. When you're teaching out in the open air where people are free to come and go unobtrusively and at will, this is a good way to arrest attention, to use a story. Jesus didn't leave his principles of his new way as abstractions. He just brought them down to earth. Instead of saying, beware of ostentation in religion, he said, don't blow a trumpet when you give. That's a lot more picturesque. All the world loves a story, from childhood upward. I used to sit by the hour and listen to stories, either being read to me or told to me by older people. Not only stories about the Bible, but stories about what tornadoes had done, how they would lift up a barn and take all the hay out and then put the barn back right on the foundation. I heard stories when I was a boy about hoop snakes and joint snakes and on and on, and I never tired of it. Probably the world remembers Jesus' parables more than about anything else he did. A parable is a comparison. The word literally means a throwing alongside. One thing is placed beside another for the purpose of comparison. Sometimes we say that a parable is an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. That's not bad, but it's not quite broad enough to include all of the parables. Jesus said that physician, heal thyself was a parable in Luke 4, verse 23. We might be more likely to call it a proverb, but he called it a parable. Jesus' statements that the thing that proceeds out of a man are those that defile the man, that's also called a parable in Mark chapter 7, verses 15 through 17. It's a kind of a riddle that prompts people to ask themselves, what is it that comes out of me that's more important than what I take in? The word parable, as used in the Gospels, is a loose term, and it may mean simply a figurative saying. Actually, there are around 200 different varieties of figures of speech used in the Bible, and parables are just one variety. Most of the parables of Jesus are comparisons assuming the form of stories. It's really interesting, to me at least, that the writers of the New Testament, though they sometimes used allegories and similitudes, they don't really resort to the story parable that was used by Jesus so frequently. We have it occasionally in the Old Testament. We have the parable of the vineyard in Isaiah chapter 5, and we have the most famous Old Testament parable, the one about the little ewe lamb that Nathan the prophet told to King David in 2 Samuel 12, verses 1 through 7. And David reacts to that story just exactly as we would expect, and Nathan only had to respond with four words, "Thou art the man." That's the way Jesus used parables too, by telling a story that was true to life. He would draw a parallel between earthly things and heavenly things, and then teach the principles that count in God's kingdom by using this parable. Sometimes he'd start by asking people, what do you think? I wish we knew what the inflection was. Did he say, what do you think? Or what do you think? You know, I'd like to know how he was saying. It would mean a lot to me if I had the inflection that Jesus used. But again, I obviously don't need it. Sometimes at the end of the story, Jesus would ask his hearers for a verdict on what they had heard in the story. He would start a story and they would follow him, sometimes not realizing where he was leading them. And then at the end it would hit them and they could not contradict what he had said. Same thing as Nathan with David. David's sins had lulled his conscience to sleep, and without knowing it, David judged his own case and pronounced the death sentence on himself. It's impossible to lay down strict rules for the interpretation of the parables. The amount of comparison varies from one parable to another. In the parable of the sower, even the birds and the sons are important. But in the parable of the prodigal son, the fatted calf and the music and the dancing don't seem to have any specific meaning. So we don't need to ask, what did the swine stand for? Or what does the ring on the finger represent? Failure to recognize that all the details of a parable are not meaningful has led astray many people in their understanding of the parables. We need to distinguish between a parable and an allegory. In an allegory, it's like the Pilgrim's Progress, or in the Bible, it's like the story that I think Ted read yesterday in Galatians 4, verses 24 through 31. There's an allegory used there, and in an allegory, every detail does have an inner meaning. An allegory, like a parable, is a story told to make a comparison, but allegories have a meaning for each point. Paul uses that one about Hagar and Sarah to contrast the old covenant with the new. Hagar represents the old, Sarah represents the new, and every other detail in that allegory corresponds to something. But in a parable, each detail is not necessarily significant, and in our Bible classes and our personal study, I believe it's very important for us to recognize that. The details in a parable are most often there just to add color to the story and maybe to make it more memorable. And I'm stressing this point because in ancient and medieval times it became customary to treat the parables of Jesus as if they were allegories. I'll give you one example from Origen, who lived in the 3rd century. He was one of the worst offenders at this. In his understanding of the parable of the Good Samaritan, he said that the man who fell among thieves was Adam. Jerusalem represents heaven. Jericho represents the world. The thieves are the devil and his henchmen. The priest stands for the law. The Levite stands for the prophets. And the Good Samaritan stands for Christ himself. The beast on which the wounded man is placed is Christ's body, bearing the fallen Adam. The inn is the church. The two pence are the Father and the Son. The Good Samaritan promises that he will come back again, meaning that Christ will come again at the end of the world. For centuries, this is the kind of interpretation offered for the parables, but the Lord never intended for us to overthink his parables like that. There's no need to allegorize the parables. The first thing to do with any given parable is to find the central truth being set forth there. What is the main lesson of the story? And once we grasp that main truth, we can evaluate all the related truths with reference to the whole framework of the story. If the parable of the sower mainly illustrates how the Word of God is received by different kinds of human hearts, then all the other parts of that parable are to be understood in that light. The symbolism in Jesus' parables is never thickly layered and rarely even multidimensional. In most cases, the parables make one simple point. Jesus is speaking outside. The parables are simple on purpose, and the lessons they teach are uncomplicated. Common sense goes a long way in understanding the parables. The second thing to do with the parable is to understand it in the light of the circumstances of its origin. Where did it come from? The background of the parable and the context of the passage in which it appears will help in grasping the meaning that the Lord intended for us to get from it. The context of some of the parables suggests that there are several lessons to be learned. In the parable of the sower, for example, Jesus clearly intends to provoke thought about a number of things pertaining to the kingdom, so he gives us his own explanation of the parable of the sower and supplies the meanings of a story that otherwise could be somewhat obscure. In the 13th chapter of the book of Matthew, which itself contains 7 parables, Jesus was asked why he taught in parables. And interestingly, he said that while the parables were used to illustrate and clarify truth for those with ears to hear and those who were sincere seekers of truth, they had the opposite effect on those who opposed and rejected Christ, because their unbelief was stubborn, it was rebellious, it was deliberate, and it was by their own choice, and so the truth was hidden from them. The same parable would elaborate for a person who was sincere and honest, and it would hide the truth from somebody else who was not of the same nature. For those who remained unyielding in their refusal to hear, the unexplained parables remained riddles without a clear meaning. By the way, Jesus did not always speak in parables. There's a statement made in Mark chapter 4, verses 33 and 34, where it is said there that without a parable he did not speak unto them. This has led some to believe that he always talked all the time in parables. But obviously, most of the Sermon on the Mount is just straightforward sermonic exhortation, though he does choose to close it with a short parable about the wise and foolish builders. But that statement in Mark 4, which says without a parable he did not speak to them, is just a description of the public teaching style of Jesus during the final year or so of his public ministry. There had been events, of course, that prompted Jesus to adopt this style. Our topic is 40 is enough. And it's difficult to say just how many parables there are in the Gospels. The precise number, again, depends on the method of counting. It depends on your definition of a parable. If we include proverbs and riddles and simple comparisons, then we could run the number up as high as 60. If we use a tight definition, we could have it as low as 30 or 35. Giving a technical definition that fits all of Jesus' parables is notoriously difficult since they're so different from each other. It's quite a range of sayings that are expressly labeled as parables in the Synoptic Gospels. We've already talked about that idea. I should mention that the word parable is from a Greek word that's almost the same as our English word parable, parabole. Its word is normally translated as parable, and it is used 50 times in 48 verses in the New Testament. Para meaning beside, babo meaning to throw, so a parable means to throw alongside. It just suggests a comparison between two things that are alike in some way. And the idea is retained in the English derivative, the word parabola, which describes a curve where one side precisely mirrors the other. A parable is an illustrative figure of speech made for the sake of comparison to teach a spiritual lesson. And the lesson revealed in the comparison is the central and often the only point of the parable. It's not like Pilgrim's Progress, where every character and virtually every plot point conveys some vital meaning. Parables are not intended to be mined for layer upon layer of secret significance. Their lessons are simple and focused without much embellishment. Jesus said that many prophets and kings have desired to see what you see in his day and have not seen it, and to hear what you have heard and not heard it. Luke 10, verses 23 and 24. These have been passed down to us, and we are very blessed to have these parables and be able to understand them. The biblical idea of a parable is broader than most of the definitions proposed by commentators, and that's why getting an exact count of the parables of Jesus is tricky. So once again, just as with the writers of the Bible and just as with the miracles of Jesus, we have to say about 40. We should recognize that Jesus' parables never feature elements of myth. There's never any fantasy involved there. They're nothing like Aesop's fables. In Aesop's fables, you have personified forest creatures teaching moral lessons, but there's nothing like that. The parables of Jesus are all believable. They're all true to life's illustrations. They could all, in fact, be things that had actually happened. Jesus was not the first to use the form, but he may have been the first to teach in parables as extensively as he did. Old Hillel the Elder, one of the most famous rabbis of all time, lived a generation before Christ, and he is said to have spoken occasionally in parables. The Midrash, which is a collection of rabbinical sayings, commentaries, and illustrations dating from the 2nd century AD, includes a few older parables that are thought to predate the time of Christ. But Jesus was the premier user of parables. And by the way, the book of John contains not one single parable. The book of John does not even use the word parable, although a word of similar meaning is used, the word paroimia. A parable is to a paroimia as a simile is to a metaphor. You're aware, as we said, that there are more than 200 varieties of figures of speech used in the Bible. Two of the simplest are simile and metaphor. Simile uses words like and as to make a comparison. The kingdom of heaven is like. Metaphor leaves out the like or the as and just says is. Jesus took bread and said, "This is my body." He didn't say, "This is like my body," or "This represents my body," or "This is emblematic of my body." He took juice and said, "This is my blood." He said, "I am the door. I am the good shepherd." So there are no parables in the book of John at all, though there are some paroimias. We find the word paroimia used in John 10, verse 6, and in John 16, verses 25 and 29. To find the parables of Jesus, though, we go to the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Only a few parables occur in the book of Mark because Mark was writing for the Romans, and the Romans were interested in action, so Mark concentrates on what Jesus did rather than what he said, and that seems to be the reason that Mark is comparatively shorter than Matthew and Luke that record more of what Jesus said. So most of the parables of Jesus are found in Matthew and Luke, and since I gave you a list of the about 40 writers of the Bible and the about 40 miracles of Jesus, I think for completion I should give you a list of the about 40 parables of Jesus. this, and then we'll have a balance in the Lord's words and works. So, first of all, I'm going to give you a list of seven that are recorded in all of the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Number one, the children of the bride chamber. And again, I have references for these, but it would be so cumbersome, and you understand these very well anyway. The children of the bride chamber is number one. Two is new patches on old garments. Three, new wine and old wineskins. Four, the parable of the sower. Five, the parable of the mustard seed. Six, the wicked husbandman. And seven, the fig tree. Those are in all of the Synoptic Gospels. Five more are recorded in both Matthew and Luke. Number eight, the wise and foolish builders. Number nine, the children in the marketplace. Number 10, the leaven. Number 11, the lost sheep. Number 12, the wise steward. But most of Jesus' parables are recorded in only one gospel account. Only in Matthew we have these. Number 13, the tares. 14, the hidden treasure. Number 15, the pearl of great price. Number 16, the dragnet. Number 17, the householder. Number 18, the unmerciful servant. Number 19, the parable of the laborers in the vineyard. Number 20, the two sons. Number 21, the marriage of the king's son and the wedding garment. Number 22, the 10 virgins. Number 23, the talents. And number 24, the parable of the sheep and the goats, portraying the last great judgment scene. Only in the book of Mark we have two parables. Number 25, the seed growing of itself, and number 6, the porter on watch. Finally, only in the book of Luke we have the concluding list of parables. Number 27, the two debtors. Number 28, the good Samaritan. Number 29, the friend at midnight. Number 30, the rich fool. Number 31, the watchful servants. Number 32, the barren fig tree. Number 33, the chief seats. 34, the feast for the poor. 35, the great supper. 36, the tower. 37, the king. 38, the lost coin. 39, the prodigal son. 40, the dishonest steward. 41, the master and the servants. 42, the persistent widow. 43, the Pharisee and the publican. And number 44, the pounds in Luke chapter 19. That's a list of 44, which is about 40. And you personally can add or delete from that list according to your personal conclusions. For example, some think that the narrative of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16, verses 19 through 31, is a parable, and it's possible that it might be. But bear in mind that there is a difference between a story made up by Jesus as an illustration and a chronicle of events that actually happened. For as long as I can remember, people have discussed whether the story of the rich man and Lazarus is a parable or an actual historical account. I'll just say a few things about that from my perspective. There's nothing in Luke's record to indicate that it is a parable. However, the parable of the dishonest steward earlier in the chapter begins the same way. There was a rich man. But I just want to say this. If the rich man and Lazarus is a parable, it is unique among the parables in that it gives a name to one of its characters. Now, the rich man is often known as Dives, which is the Latin word for rich, but that's not part of the actual account in Luke, and that's not what I'm talking about. Jesus does describe the beggar and calls him Lazarus, which was a common name in Jesus' time and place. It's the Greek form of the Hebrew name Eliezer. If this is a parable, I cannot account for the fact that Jesus gives a name to a character in the story when he never did that in any other parable, and I can't see any reason why he would do that in this if it is a parable. Why name a character Lazarus when you could just continue to say beggar and keep the story generic like a parable would tend to be? So personally, I doubt that it's a parable, but if you think it is, you can add it to your list of about 40. Main point of the class is that about 40 writers of the Bible gave us enough. About 40 recorded miracles of Jesus are enough. About 40 recorded parables of Jesus are enough. I think it's already been pointed out that 40 days of Moses on the mountain was enough to test the children of Israel, and they flunked the test. But 40 days of fasting was enough to test Jesus in the wilderness, and he passed with flying colors. As Dane mentioned on day number one, The number 40 seems to have substantial significance in the Bible. I think it occurs about 159 times. At the time of the global flood, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Moses, Elijah, and Jesus, as Dane pointed out on Monday, each fasted for 40 days without food or water. The Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Ezekiel lay on his right side for 40 days. Saul, David, and Solomon each reigned for 40 years. Goliath taunted Israel for 40 days before David defeated him. Jonah declared that Nineveh would be destroyed in 40 days if they didn't repent. After his resurrection, Jesus appeared to his apostles and talked with them for 40 days, the number 40 seeming to be emblematic of testing, trial, and spiritual growth, 40 being enough. And by the way, this is considered so right up to our own time. Many of our denominational friends observe Lent, which is a 40-day period of fasting, prayer, and penance leading up to the festival called Easter. Many of our Muslim friends believe that a deceased person's soul remains at the place of death for 40 days, which is a period also often marked by prayer and remembrance. And I'll say this just in closing in our last minute and a half. 40 days is enough for you to establish a new habit in your life. New habits form just like the old ones form through repetition. That's why Paul exhorted Timothy to exercise himself unto godliness. Make it a habit. 1 Timothy 4, verse 7. If you practice something for 40 days in a row, you are setting new neural pathways through your nervous system. Whatsoever you do, do it heartily as unto the Lord and not to men. Colossians 3:23. And if you do it for 40 days in a row, you will have a new habit, so much so that if you don't do it on the 41st day, it'll seem like something is missing, because 40 is enough. Thanks, everybody.